Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 9 a.m., Wednesday, February 17th, 2010. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Egan, Senator Thomas, and Senator Huggins. We have Senator Joe Pascavan is in the room, and I see nobody else, but there'll be other folks coming in and out, senators. Today, we're going to hear two presentations from the Department of Revenue dealing with lease expenditures. And the first part of the presentation will be production tax lease expenditure regulations. And following that, we'll roll into operating and capital expenditures and how they intertwine. The subject matter gets a little complicated and cumbersome. Hopefully, we should finish today by this, late this afternoon, to stay on schedule. So I'd like to, take the time to get a good review of this subject matter, but keep, on our schedule so we can get this wrapped up next week and go on to some other committee business. And we're going to take a brief at ease. come back on the record. With us today from the Department of Revenue is Mr. John Larson, Audit Master for DOR, and Marcia Davis, Deputy Commissioner of DOR. And they have a presentation that they're going to walk through dealing with regulations. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
And we may stop you from time to time. I'll just interrupt you to try to explain a few things. It's when we drop into the middle of some of these topics, it gets kind of confusing what impact it has in the tax calculation and where it flows in and how it affects the state or the industry. And so I'll from time to time probably stop you. We'll just kind of take it from there. We'll try to, we'll just take whatever time we have to take to get through this, and then we'll deal with the next subject matter. Deputy Commissioner, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and take it away.
Thank you, Chairman Stedman. My name is Marcia Davis. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue. And today we're going to walk you through the production tax lease expenditure regulations and the process whereby we arrived at these regulations and the statutory underpinning for those regulations. As you all recall, ACES was passed late in 2007. It was passed very, very shortly after a prior law had been passed called the PPT. Prior to that, all of for the prior 20 plus years, Alaska's oil and gas had been calculated on a gross basis. Therefore, there had been a long, long standing history of a pattern of calculating taxes without regard to costs incurred by the operators on the slope. It was rather just simply look at the gross revenue, deduct the transportation cost, and you would derive a tax. There were elements of cost associated with the economic limit factor determination, but other than that, on a yearly basis, the tax was calculated fairly directly and simply. When the law was changed to a net-based tax, that essentially required the department and the taxpayers to start to focus on the operating expenses and the capital expenses, the overhead charges, lots of costs that come up in the course of producing oil and gas. And those costs were going to be deductible against the gross revenue so that we could arrive at a taxable value against which the tax rate is applied. Because the when the PPT was filed, pretty short order, it was clear that it was going to be revisited. The department didn't launch off on a regulatory writing mission until we knew the water was settled as far as what we were going to have as far as production tax. So the regulation process began in earnest immediately after ACES was passed. And it is a process that's governed by the Administrative Procedures Act. The Department of Revenue worked diligently with the Department of Law in terms of making sure all of our processes complied with the Administrative Procedures Act. But one of the things that we did differently this time around, and it probably is my fault because having been in the oil and gas industry for 9 years, I understood firsthand the frustration the industry sometimes feels when state agencies do a regulation process, a project, particularly one that involves a fairly intricate understanding of the practices and the norms and the constraints that industry has when they are required to collect cost data and explain sort of how all the money flows in the system. So what we chose to do at for these regulations was before we launched on what is the typical process, which is the agency drafts a draft regulation in a way they think is optimum. They put it out for a 30-day public comment. The public, including industry, then submits comments to which the agency then stops and responds in writing or responds in some fashion to every single comment. And it all is a very formal sort of slow, cumbersome communication process. We wanted to have workshops because this was so new and so different that we really did want to flesh out every possible issue that was out there and give ourselves an opportunity to really understand the lay of the land before we launched off with our design or our paradigm structure for our regulations. So we gave a notice of workshops on topics, whether it was the lease expenditure, capital cost, overhead, transportation cost, whatever the element might be. And we put out a notice, and we had the public and industry come. They were allowed to participate by telephone. We ensured ample opportunity for participation. And in the course of those workshops, the first ones were a little quiet, I would say, because people weren't sure of the process. But once they understood and trusted the process and realized that it was a very fruitful endeavor to communicate and to be open and forthright with their concerns, we had very, very rigorous workshop processes. So what got thrown on the table was the exasperation concerns of industry, the public, and we were able to learn a lot in that process. And as we learned, our design of the regs sometimes changed drastically. Sometimes it was merely refined. But what we ended up with by the end of, on very controversial topics, we'd sometimes have up to three workshops. What we ended up with were regulations that fit the circumstances better, more like a glove to the hand. And by the time we did then finalize the draft regs that went out for the 30-day public comment period, we pretty much had heard all the comments we were going to hear and had either resolved them, addressed them, or reconciled how we were approaching it versus the comments that we received. Obviously, then we followed the APA process and noticed our regulations in the newsprint, and then when we got comments at that stage, responded to all of those as well. A lot of folks have made comments about, gosh, where are those ACES regulations? You know, what have you guys been doing? Falling asleep at the switch. And I'm not going to go through all of this. This is on our website that basically is our archive of activities. But what we were faced with when we first started off with ACES regulations is, as you recall, that happened at the very end of the year. Well, March 31st was the date for filing the tax return for the tax year 2007. So you had a lot of taxpayers out there throwing their hands up saying, what do I do? How am I going to file my return? So our first attention was spent on forms, how to provide the taxpayer public with a format for reporting their taxes under the new law. And a lot of effort went into those workshops. We had a lot of IT issues. The tax is not, we are not set up to handle things on a automated fashion. So there were a lot of Excel spreadsheets, a lot of different things had to be come up with to ensure that all the data was captured. So after we got through the crisis of giving people the monthly forms, and as you recall, the tax return was only one of the forms required under under the new production tax law. In addition, because each taxpayer must file a monthly estimate of their taxes, there's a monthly form that has to be filed as well. We had to derive a form for that purpose. As we work through our forms, we also, interestingly, were hit almost right off the bat with a tool that we thought would be useful, and that's an advisory bulletin. Because the legislature gave the department the authority to issue advisory bulletins, we pretty quickly got asked for inquiries about how a particular tax law was going to be interpreted under given circumstances. So during the time period we were working on the regulations, we were also issuing a couple of these advisory bulletins. But as we worked through transportation, we worked through the lease expenditures, the overhead charges. We had mid-year and conforming changes that really related to how we were going to adapt the law to the timing, different timing elements of the new law. Reimbursements under 170, which were essentially the facility sharing focused regs, those were a big topic of concern and issue because we had some facility sharing arrangements hanging in the balance based on what the regulations and how the state was going to interpret its facility sharing issues. Working through 2009 here, still some more advisory bulletins and still form issues. And we get here to the present day, and what isn't on that list are the regulations we just sent out the door last week that relate to transportation deductions. Those were held up till last because we knew that because of the open season coming here shortly, May 1st, one of the things that the tax department really owed producers and others was a clear understanding of how we would be deducting not only the oil transportation costs associated in connection with the tax, but we needed to have a very clear statement on how we would handle gas transportation costs and how those could be deducted and applied in the tax calculation. So it took us a little bit of time to get up to speed on the differences between oil and gas transportation costs and regulatory requirements, et cetera, and gain a full understanding of all the pieces in the gas transportation system that are different than the oil transportation system, including a gas treatment plant and the manner in which it would flow through Canada and the whole new issue of markets and how we would derive a market value for gas that gets tendered, whether it's in Valdez or Canada. So we ultimately arrived at and got those regulations completed. Unfortunately, I have to apologize to industry. We did not have time to go out for workshops on that particular set of regulations. They are out now for public comment, so there will be, I'm sure, a lot more comments than we've had in the earlier processes because we couldn't do the workshop process. But they are out there, so at least it's a message to industry about what we're thinking about with respect to the tax handling of those costs.
Could you, Ms. Davis, could you spin us up a little bit on the last sentence of first paragraph?
Four relate to, of those remaining, 17 relate to transportation. What we're referring to is sections of the regulation that need to either be revised or added. So in the transportation regulations that we have just put out, there are approximately 17 provisions contained in that packet of what we would consider the regulations that govern how oil transportation costs are deducted from the gross revenue to arrive at the production tax value, and also for gas. And that's and when I say AGIA issues, it's simply the gas transportation costs. And then with respect to facility sharing and BTU heating value, those are the provisions that on the facility sharing side relate to AS 4355-170. And that provision is the one that we had learned through our workshops and through discussions with industry had been actually creating a barrier to facility sharing on the North Slope. Because the producers read that statute and had to read it in a very defensive manner, in other words, protect themselves in the event that the state essentially considered the payments that they received entirely something that they had to offset against their lease expenditures, there was a significant tax impact to them. Therefore, to protect themselves in a facility sharing arrangement, they had to take all of the payments that they were receiving from a new entrant coming in wanting to share their facility, and they had to gross them up multiples of times. So the cost to share facilities was unnecessarily high because of the uncertainty around the interpretation of that particular statute. So in the course of the workshops and a lot of the intensive research that Mr. Larson here did in examining all of the facility sharing agreements that we are aware of on the North Slope, we were able by regulation to parse out and break out each element and state definitively how it would be treated as either a lease expenditure offset or not. And in the instances where it was very clear it was not a lease expenditure offset, then the parties were free to negotiate a fee without concern about its tax impact. I'd say that was probably one of our more successful endeavors at arriving at an understanding of industry's situation, the parties' situation, and ensuring that our tax law was not the barrier in that instance. And
the fundamental issue is opening the basin and having other participants being able to access these facilities, or exactly what is the issue at hand?
Senator Stedman, absolutely, that is the policy that's at stake. When you have a tax law that requires a facility owner to report any payment that it receives in some fashion that may result in their having an increased tax bill, that certainly does create an onus for a facility owner as to whether they should or should not share their facility. So we were able to, using the strict understanding interpretation of the production tax, we were able to break through the various elements of facility sharing, which included essentially a facility owner requiring a sharing party to pay its proportionate share of operating expense associated with the other party's production. That, by our interpretation, is not a payment that the facility owner would have to report as offsetting its own lease expenditure, because that cost is actually not something that the facility owner could report as its own lease expenditure. It is not a cost associated with the production of its own oil and gas. It's a cost associated with the new entity or the new entrance cost of production. But we had to make that clear that that was how we were interpreting it in order for them to be comfortable that they didn't have to gross up that type of a payment. The same is true with a contribution to capital expense. As long as it's a, you know, future capital expense, then if it's just the proportionate share, as long as the parties divided up so they're each paying their own proportionate share, there was no tax consequence. In addition, there are issues about a new party coming in and sharing. When they share a facility, they may back out the production of the facility owner's production, because generally in a facility sharing arrangement, you want the operator of that facility to operate at optimum efficiency. And what that means is they will take the oil or gas that has the optimum, the least amount of water associated with it, doesn't create an impediment on their gas handling, for instance. So you'll take low GOR type production. And invariably, if the new entrant comes in with higher quality oil, it's going to back out the original owner's older or maybe lower quality oil. And so a facility owner will require that they be made whole downstream. And so we had a way of dealing with that production share payment as well. So we broke it out and did our best to give clarity to the situation. And we have received comments from Pioneer at Ugaruk, several of the other companies, including the AOGA, that they were very pleased that we were able to work out this process.
And for those at home, the cost of these facilities are such magnitude to make it very difficult for a firm like Pioneer, for instance, to come in and build their own facility. Mm-hmm. That would be an entry barrier, is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
On the third paragraph, dealing with the transportation and the GEA-related regulations, the issue of in-kind and in value regulation, is that going to be in place by the May 1st? And then maybe you can define for those at home what in-kind and in-value is and why we should have an interest in that.
Senator Stedman, there's two pieces of the AGEA-related inducements that are at play here in terms of the open season. Under AS 4390-300, there is the opportunity for someone who wants to ship in the licensed gas pipeline to come forward and make a commitment to ship during the initial open season. If they do so in a manner that satisfies both the department, the Commissioner of Natural Resources and the Commissioner of Revenue, in other words, their commitment is not so conditioned as to make it illusory, for instance, or, you know, kind of meaningless. And there is going to be a regulation that is put out both by DNR and by DOR that defines what type of commitment will qualify, will be significant enough that it merits getting these inducements. Then assuming that they've passed through that gate, DNR is issuing regulations that will govern and make it very clear what the royalty inducement is, and that involves, as you say, Chairman Stedman, the issue of DNR clarifying how they take their royalty oil, the state's share of the oil, in value or in kind, in a manner that does not disrupt the commercial arrangements of the shipper in making their plans to ship their gas in a gas line. Those regulations by law are required to be in place certainly during the open season, so that at the time that the commitment has to be made, it's very clear what they are. The Department of Revenue, for its part, has a provision, 4390-320. Under that provision, the Department of Revenue will treat gas that is committed in the open season, the initial open season, in a certain way, and that certain way is this. Whatever gas is committed at that open season is entitled to claim the tax treatment in place on the first day of the initial open season. Therefore, DOR has a more short time frame. We have to have whatever our regulation is in place that governs, for instance, how we're going to deduct gas transportation costs, et cetera. That has to be in place on May 1st.
Of what year?
Of the coming year, 2010.
This year,
correct.
This May 1st.
And once that right exists, then what they have a right to is to claim that treatment if it's more favorable, and if they want it, it'll be treated as essentially an exemption. It'll basically make sure that they have that tax treatment for the volume of gas that was committed in that pipeline for 10 years from the beginning of flow of gas in that pipe for 10 years. Now, if the law were to change subsequent to May 1st, and it were to change in a way that made the tax more favorable to a shipper, for instance, if there was some sort of negotiation or something down the road and there was a decision made that the tax treatment would be more favorable, that is certainly available, and there's no restriction on that happening. What the provision in the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act does, though, is ensure it can't get worse than the law that was in place on May 1st.
Back up a bit. This also applies to oil? You keep referring to gas. Is it oil?
No,
and gas, or just
actually,
gas?
The exemption only applies to gas, Senator Stedman.
And when you mean get worse, you need to define that, because our debits are credit and vice versa.
That's true. It's two sides of a coin. What I mean by get worse is meaning from an industry perspective, your tax will not be greater than it would otherwise be on May 1st, using the laws in place at May 1st for the volume of gas that is committed to the pipeline.
Senator Thomas.
That was my question, but also wanted to clarify it. That would be for, could you create a tax that would be worse for someone that is a new shipper versus the one that's tax is in effect as of May 1st?
Marcia, if you could go over binding open season, the first binding open season and preceding open seasons, if there is any.
I haven't been part of the AGEA team working all the details on the nuances of open season, so my understanding may not be totally dead on. But as I understand it, the initial open season is the first open season. It's been announced and authorized under the FERC law. And so the notice, it begins on a firm date, May 1st, and I believe it's being held open for 90 days for 3 months, May, June, and July, to the end of July. And during that time period, there is a substantial amount of going back and forth between the pipeline company and a potential shipper, because they can negotiate an agreement whereby the pipeline accepts an offer to ship subject to certain circumstances. And because these regulations are just been put out for public comment, it would be inappropriate under the APA for us to comment and describe too much what it is. We have to stay within that process. But during that time period, the open season, there's just a lot of going back and forth, and each company strikes its own deal during that time period. Now, there are obviously constraints under FERC law that would prohibit unlawful discrimination and a lot of other things. So my guess is that, you know, there are certainly binders on what the, under FERC, what the pipeline company can agree or not agree to.
So, and then the second open season, this is not applicable.
That's correct. Once you have one open season, then the pipeline company sits back and regroups and looks at the type of commitments it got in its first open season and make a decision as to whether or not it's they have enough to go forward with a project that's commercial and it's one that they want to go forward with, or whether they want to go forward, have a second open season, and then they'd go out and do another round to see if there's anything else they can do to beat the bushes, and maybe circumstances have changed in the environment, the economy, or a particular company's circumstances, in which case they may get more commitments. And as they develop in a subsequent open season, if there is one, that party does not qualify under the existing AGEA law for these inducements. You have to show up at the initial open season.
And if you can add just a little bit on the transferability, if a firm happens to show up and maybe subscribe to, mm-hmm. make it simple, 100% of the capacity, mm-hmm. and their ability to transfer this certificate.
Senator Stedman, an important provision in AGEA is the recognition that not all shippers are those that own gas on the North Slope and are going to, you know, basically know they have the gas and ship it. We envision that there could be large, cooperatives of utilities, for instance, or there might be a large utility in California that basically needs the gas, wants the gas, and is going to go ahead and make a commitment to acquire gas on the North Slope and ship it itself. So we recognized, but they themselves would not be a taxpayer because they are not a producer of oil and gas. So we made sure there was provision in AGEA that would enable them to transfer the benefit of that tax inducement or that royalty inducement to the entity, to the producer from whom they buy the gas, in an effort to ensure that it broadened the number of potential shippers that could show up and make for a successful initial open season. So they are transferable.
And then one other example, and we'll use the current number just to make it simple, because the concept, if for instance I subscribe the entire volume of the pipe, all 4.5 BCF, in the first binding open season, and then after the fact at the second or third open season, I decide to split two-thirds of the volume amongst the six members here, can that certificate that I have be allocated amongst these guys, or do I get to keep it all myself?
Senator Stedman, to be honest, I'm not entirely clear on that one. My assumption would be it would be transferable, because what we're trying to do is ensure that people make that commitment at that initial open season, but I'm not entirely certain of that answer.
Right. We can check that out. Mm-hmm. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question that I have is in an article that I read, I believe in Monday's paper, saying that the administration said that we're open for business and inviting China to Alaska. What provisions are included in that you see that are in the regulations or in the law that would allow that to happen? Mm-hmm.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that would be similar to the situation that would involve, say, a large utility group in the lower 48. If I were representing a large Chinese conglomerate or company that was interested in say, building a petrochemical plant in Alaska, let's say I'm going to strip off ethane, and basically make ethylene beads, put it in a tanker, and you know, tanker it over to China to make plastics, for instance. What I would do is I would make arrangements to acquire gas, a volume of gas, from a North Slope producer. Under that arrangement, either I myself would be the shipper from the North Slope into the AGEA system, or I would buy it somewhere down the pipe and take off the ethane and then simply let the North Slope shipper maintain the commitment. But in the latter, in the former circumstance, if I were the Chinese company, I would then be showing up at open season and wanting to make a commitment. Once I knew what volume of gas I needed, I would make a commitment to ship gas in the volume, whatever the volume was that I was going to have to use as my feedstock in. And I would then lock down the rights to the royalty and the tax inducement, which I could then pass on to the producer from whom I purchased the North Slope gas.
And I assume the value of this is only if the tax is lower than higher.
The value would be if the tax subsequently is increased or raised, although certainly there is a value in having that type of insurance policy, because as you're making your calculations for the commerciality of your project, it helps to know that there's that, you know what your tax is going to be at least for a period of 10 years.
Right. Senator Hoffman.
And in order to have that accomplished, what, if anything, has to happen at the federal level?
Because the constraint is on the export of LNG, I do not believe there's a federal prohibition on a Chinese company exporting the ethylene product, for instance, because that's essentially a manufactured product. It would be made in the U.S., and it's my understanding there are some federal constraints on ownership of the manufacturing plant, and so it would require an American partner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marcia, what you're describing under AGEA would also apply and work under interstate gas, it appears. If the Chinese came, wanted to build a petrochemical plant at Point McKenzie or Kenai and created a demand for a large volume of gas that made it economical, same provisions would apply, not the open season breaks, but because we have in-state gas tax provision. But what's the difference in those two scenarios?
Senator Huggins, through the chair, you're correct. Essentially, if a in-state line were built and gas was taken, purchased on the slope and shipped down the line, it certainly would be similar to the what we call an industrial anchor user that we've been describing, that would be important for a project such as a gas line from the North Slope down towards Cook Inlet to be economical. That's precisely the type of anchor, you know, that you'd need for that type of pipeline. You're also correct that the AGEA inducements would not be available for that, so the constraint on changing the tax rate for the gas or the royalty in kind versus royalty in value changes wouldn't be there. However, certainly right now what we have is the state of the law today, not paying any attention to the bills that are currently in this body right now, is that the gas used to fuel that plant for energy, for electricity, and for power would have the lower tax rate associated with Cook Inlet gas, which is pretty much locked in at 17 cents. But the feedstock, the ethane that went into the plant, would be taxed at a normal tax rate. There are currently pending bills on, at least I know on the House side, I think it's House Bill 217, that would purport to give that ethane gas the favored tax rate.
Just follow up and then we'll get back on track. We're going to come back and work this.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, and we're going to work this issue some more along with how accurate you can forecast our gas tax once we're locked in.
That sounds good.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay. One of the questions was that we were asked to address here today was how much discretion is there for both the department to have arrived at what are the appropriate deductible lease expenditures, and how much discretion was left in the hands of industry in responding and identifying the lease expenditures that were going to be deducted. And I wanted to just simply walk through the relevant provisions that we dealt with when we were writing the lease expenditure regulations to identify what could be deducted as capital expense, operating expense, and the overhead.
And if you could, Marcia, refresh us, too, on how it's treated at the corporate level.
Okay.
Operating and capital expenditures.
Right.
Regardless of what we exclude or include.
Okay. And I'm shortly going to do a handoff here, but let me just set up the framework here as far as what we went through. The statute gives us directions, and it basically tells the department that the lease expenditures that we allow to be deducted must meet three requirements. First, they must be incurred upstream of the point of production, and that's essentially for purposes of understanding it, it's the place in the system where you've come out of the processing plants and it's getting ready to go into the transportation mode. For oil, that would be at the entry point to the pump station one. For gas, it would be in between the stage where gas gets processed. In other words, you've removed the oil and the water and those kinds of things, but before it gets treated. And what that means is the treatment is generally where you knock out the water and the CO2, if I'm correct, John?
Yes.
Yeah. Essentially, it's what you have to do further to the gas to make sure it can be put into the gas pipeline in a marketable condition. And so those are generally, they have criteria for how much CO2 it can have, and you've got to just strip that water out of there. And for us, that's an important distinction when we start thinking about how our laws apply in a situation where we have a gas line. Because what that means is the gas treatment plant is downstream of the point of production, which means those costs are not considered lease expenditures and are not deductible against the tax. Secondly, the cost must be ordinary and necessary costs of exploring for and developing or producing the oil or gas. And ordinary and necessary is a term of art, and we were directed by the statute, and you'll see it a little later on. We use this definition used by the IRS for defining what is ordinary and necessary.
Can you repeat that again? Mm-hmm.
The ordinary and necessary cost definition, in the statutes, it defines that as being the IRS code definition for that phrase. And I've got a cite to that here in a later slide, okay. Senator Stedman. And finally, the cost must be direct costs as opposed to indirect costs of exploring for developing or producing gas deposits. And then there will be further statutory direction on that. 165B essentially tells us more information about what is a direct cost. And it directs that, it basically states that we must consider a direct cost being the cost of an asset, even if it is capitalized by the corporation on its books under its accounting principles, or regardless of whether that cost is capitalized under IRS rules. We also get directions that the payment of property, sales, use, motor, fuel, and excise tax are also included. And finally, there was concern about how the department would interpret lease expenditures as being direct, whether that implied that they needed to be physically located on the slope. And the answer from the legislative body was that no, as long as activity directly touches and concerns and affects the oil and gas lease, it does not have to actually be physically on the oil and gas lease.
So, Ms. Davis, could you, I know you don't speak for the industries, and I'm not asking you to do that, but why would some people be very uncomfortable with this part of the statute?
I believe, Senator Stedman, that what had been expressed during the session was concern that that standard could be manipulated by industry. In other words, that there could be costs incurred back in a corporate headquarters building that might not really affect directly the operation, but it would be easy to load those costs in. That was one instance. In another instance, there was concern that the department not allow direct costs of, say, building a module, say, in Louisiana. Let's say it's an all-purpose module that could be used in several locations around the world. And the concern was that if it got built down there, we front the cost. So time value of money being what it is, we kind of let it get deducted immediately against tax. And then after 2 or 3 years of construction, it gets shipped to Saudi Arabia. Well, recognizing that there might be an adjustment, you know, later on. There was just concern that the department perhaps just should have a black line in the sand that just said, don't allow anything that's not physically in the state. However, from further testimony, it's recognized that it is a global economy. There are companies that have efficiencies that are derived from being able to do certain activities and certain things in a centralized location that do directly affect and deal with our oil and gas lease properties, but are located outside the state. So it was more a recognition of sort of the modern way companies operate. But there certainly was the concern that we not, you know, get hoodwinked into allowing a cost that really had nothing to do with the operation in the state.
So is there any risk from an industry perspective of an overzealous department tightening these regs up and excluding expenditures that shouldn't be excluded?
I think that by having this admonition in here, it was very protective of industry to basically say, we can't just simply say because the activity did not happen in the state or on the oil and gas lease that we could on that basis disallow it. So, you know, this certainly is in that direction, protecting from that type of overzealous interpretation. In addition, we were instructed to use as guidance several bodies of cost accounting principles that were out there. One of them is the industry practices and standards that were in place among operating agreements that predated the passage of PPT, and provided there were multiple owners that were in place that could have negotiated the terms of that operating agreement. We did, in fact, do that and reviewed every single operating agreement on the North Slope as guidance in our regulation development. Secondly, we were instructed that we could look at the standards that DNR used under their calculation of allowable costs for net profit leases. And finally, we were told that we should look and incorporate the concepts, regulations, and guidance issued under IRS Code 482 that deals with how you allocate income and deduction amongst a group of taxpayers. So with those directions from the legislature in the statutes, we set about creating our regulation structure for lease expenditures. And I'm going to turn this over to John. What he's going to describe is we approached it, and we have handed out copies of our regulations themselves, and you'll see it starts off with the first section, 250, and what immediately follows is section 260. But the way the legislature set up our guidelines, it fell into this structure. And that is that we first identify the types of activities and the purposes served by the cost that can be considered as a lease expenditure. Then we further define the charges that would be allowed as lease expenditures under each of those activities and purposes. So we broke it down in a very logical structure. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Larson, and you can identify yourself for the record and give a little of your background.
Thank you, Senator Stedman, and members of the committee, through the chair. My name is John Larson. I'm a master auditor with the Department of Revenue. I'm a past president of COPAS, which is the Council of Petroleum Accountant Societies, an educational organization devoted to the development of fair accounting standards. Prior to that, I was a royalty auditor for the state of Alaska before coming to the Department of Revenue. And first, to kind of just start off, I'd like to just address that maybe just a couple things that Marcia talked about that came up as questions. And the first one was the off-lease charges. And I think that's a really good question. And part of the reason, I think, for the concern for that is that historically on an oil and gas lease, typically all of the charges had to be incurred basically on site to be considered a direct charge. And you have to understand that we're looking at a long history of oil and gas leases that goes back over 100 years. With the development of electronic communications, the boundaries of the lease to a certain degree became expanded, I guess you could say. And there's functions and operations that can be performed off-site of the lease probably more efficiently and at less cost than requiring a drilling engineer to maybe be on site necessarily all the time. And so I think that industry had a valid concern there, and through the development of our regulations, we try to take a fair and balanced approach to the whole process here of exploring for developing and producing the oil and gas. And it's the department's opinion that certainly those costs are within reason, and I can talk about that later, that we do limit some of those costs to the time devoted to those activities. But I did want to clarify that question since it seemed to be kind of a point of concern there. And then the one other comment was on the transportation workshops. We put out our regulations here on February 9th, and I think that Marcia said that there had not been any workshops, and I think maybe what we went to convey was that there had been workshops in the past, but not recently before this most regulations packet. But over the term of the development of the regulations throughout this process, we've had 12 workshops addressing various types of regulations that we were proposing. And during these workshops, we had 4 separate workshops where transportation issues were discussed. And so I don't want the committee or anybody else to think that we didn't have any involvement on the transportation issues during this process, because I think that the workshops were a very productive part of the process that we went through to develop the regulations here. So having said that, and turning to the regulations themselves, and as Marcia said earlier, they're basically broken down into 2 component parts. There's the 15 AAC 55250, which is the types and activities for which lease expenditures will be allowed. And then under 15 AAC 55260, we have direct charges that apply to those types of activities. And the under 55250, the types of activities and purposes that the department will allow as lease expenditures are exploration costs, including mobilization of a drilling rig, crew costs, drilling costs, cementing, testing, processing and interpreting the data, completion, abandonment, and suspension costs. All of those types are related to the exploration of the well. And then for development and production, costs to operate and maintain the facilities, designing, constructing, acquiring. If you have a third party build those facilities for you, the cost of acquiring those are allowed as lease expenditures as well. And then under, there's kind of a third category, I guess you might say, of support activities that are necessary in order to develop and produce from the well. And these include your camps, bridges, roads, docks, landing facilities, any similar type of transportation facilities such as that, communication systems, medical systems, security, and emergency facilities. And so these are the broad categories of types of costs that are incurred on a lease or operation in order to explore for, develop, and produce the gas. And then along with that, there's the specific types of charges that will be allowed for those activities. That includes your on-site labor, which is clearly, I think, probably say unquestionably, an allowable direct charge. And then there's the off-site technical labor, which I referred to earlier. And the technical labor could be a drilling engineer. Basically, it's anybody with a specific industry skill that handles a specific type of a problem on the lease. And so in those cases for the off-site charges, we limit those charges to the time specifically devoted to those operations there. Third-party contractor costs, standby costs for a drilling rig, and this was one of the costs that we found through our workshops that industry felt was they had a strong desire for allowing that charge. Property taxes, payments in lieu of property taxes, regulatory and permitting costs, and transportation costs of fluids used for reservoir maintenance and recovery.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Can you identify where the property tax and payment in lieu of property tax are in the handout?
Yeah, that would be in 15 AAC 55260.
Which
page? 260.
I'm sorry.
Just for those watching home, we just had these regulations dropped on the desk right before the presentation started today, so we haven't had the opportunity to walk through them.
I had it circled. payments, yeah.
Paragraph 16.
On page?
15 and 16 on pages 10 and 11.
Here, let me give you back your copy. Oh, actually, it's a different page for them. I didn't give them the front pages.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Hold on. It's at bottom of page 10, top of page 11.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and continue.
I'll go through this.
Sure. There was a question about use of IRS regulations versus the department developing its own set of regulations, and in fact, the department does refer to the IRS regulations. We do specifically use IRC code 263C for intangible drilling cost, and that is used under AS 4355-023 for the capital cost for exploration credits. As Marcia alluded to earlier, we also use the ordinary and necessary cost defined by code 162 and the cost for allowance under IRS code 482. However, these costs are allowed even if a cost of an asset is capitalized for IRS purposes. And that's because under ACES there is no depreciation. All your costs are basically taken up front as they're incurred there.
Can you repeat that again? And tell us why that's important, why we should be interested in that.
Senator Stedman, the reason that there's no depreciation is that the ACES allowed the cost, I don't want to say necessarily on a cash basis, but as I think one of the incentives that was offered, that the producers are allowed to deduct the cost of the, say, a production facility as it comes online, as opposed to deducting it over time.
For production tax?
That's correct.
Yes, sir.
And for corporate income tax, they still depreciate it out?
Yes, for IRS purposes, they would be required to deduct those costs or amortize them over a period of time.
Right. Senator Egan, I thought that might get your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we capitalize costs. So what's the difference between the IRS and the state?
Senator Egan, through the chair, the difference will be, I don't know if you're just talking about a semantic difference or the actual difference.
Well, you're talking about disregarding some IRS rules, or the IRS makes the state disregard some rules. I mean, I don't understand.
Let's go over that again. It's an important concept, and it's a little bit different twist than normal. So just go over how it's treated at the corporate level for corporate income tax purposes, and then how we modified that under the production tax arrangement we have.
Senator Stedman and Senator Egan through the chair. If in a typical situation for deducting your costs for IRS, if you had an asset, you would capitalize that asset and then depreciate those costs over a period of time. Say 7 years, 10 years, whatever it might be applicable for that type of asset, and what the department does is that we allow the same. We use the IRS rules for the cost of that asset, which is capitalized on a entity's books, and that's what your capital credits will be based on. Is that cost there? But in addition to gaining the capital credits, we allow the cost of that asset to be deducted as those costs are incurred. And so if you're constructing an asset, as you incur those costs over a period of time, you get to deduct them as they're incurred, rather than half a GIA.
So you don't have to wait.
So you don't have to wait and deduct them. And I'm sorry if I took such a long time to get to the point there.
So in any given year, for instance, if we had a $2 billion capital expenditures going on in the slope, all the new capital investment that year would be depreciated out over 5, 7, 10 years, whatever it happens to be, on their corporate books. But under our production tax, everything's accelerated and treated as a regular deduction, like an operating expense. So you get operating expense immediately, all your capital expense immediately.
At the time it's incurred.
Correct. But it's treated normally under corporate income tax, otherwise it would just mess everything up. From the doing their corporate books, but it accelerates the deduction and it switches the cash flow timing issue to give them a heavier deduction in the year going in. Like this year in 2010, if they spent $1 billion in capital expenditures, they'd get an immediate deduction of $1 billion off of their revenue with a few other adjustments up. And we could go back to that top-down approach of where these deductions take place, but that's why you see the capital expenditures, if it's $2 billion or $2.5 billion in any given year, as one big lump sum coming out.
Okay.
It is a – I figured that would get your perk your ears up when we got to that one, because it is a different twist.
Senator Stedman. One of the interesting things we find when we talk to a lot of the new entrants and companies that are out trying to solicit interest in investment in Alaska, this is such an unusual provision in terms of global oil and gas handling of net tax calculation. Other countries, I think, I don't know if it's Norway or the UK, allowed the deduction spread over 2 years, and they thought that was a big deal. But we allow the deduction 100% in the year incurred, and it's our understanding that that is an element of ACES that is not well understood in the rest of the world and the investor market.
Understood by the main participants in the oil industry, but not
yes
other areas. It's a big stimulus. Go ahead and continue.
We just included two slides, which were communications we had received from AOGA. This one is, again, and I put this here simply because we do appreciate and acknowledge concern or frustration that our regulations under the new revised production tax have taken a while, but we have been pursuing it in concert with developing and understanding industry's concerns and making sure that our regulations fit the circumstances and treat parties fairly, as well as ensure the protection of the state's interests. And so in this instance, we've got AOGA acknowledging our iterative process and appreciating that their comments were taken to heart and addressed meaningfully. This is a comment from Pioneer, and again, their focus was primarily on the facility sharing regulation process because that was what their project hinged on, being able to enter into a facility sharing arrangement with the Kuparik River unit owners. And again, they very much appreciated the collaborative effort and addressing the concerns through the year and acknowledged that what we did in fact remove barriers to future sharing opportunities in the state. So, in conclusion, we'd like to thank you for letting us come forward and tell our story about the production tax regulation process. We're still closing it out. We've, as I said, have the transportation regulations that are out for public comment. We also have one element of the production tax that we have not yet tackled that we are needing to get out, and we're going to focus on that this spring, and that is the exclusion under 165E that disallows costs associated with an unplanned disruption in a production facility. So that what that exclusion was intended to do was to encourage industry to proactively make repairs, proactively get out ahead of problems in the field, so that it would minimize the amount of sort of cataclysmic and unexpected disruptions to production. So if someone isn't acting proactively and getting out there and they're just simply reacting as things break, we're disallowing those types of costs associated with the reaction. Because frankly, if you're reacting in that fashion, you're not paying, you're paying more for your fixes and you're incurring a lot more costs associated with those fixes. But what we promised the legislature when that statute was passed is our intent is not to get after every light bulb and widget and screw. We're looking at some level of materiality. So what we have been doing is doing a statistical analysis of the production disruptions, the types of costs that are associated with that, so that we can perhaps have our regulation kick in at a, you know, first or second deviation level. So we're not, we're ignoring the little bits of noise, but getting after the meaningful areas of production disruption. So that's the one piece on our horizon still to do.
And then just a basic question here on the under regulations that you handed out right before the meeting. There's a date, April 2010. Is that on the top? Is that? I'm just kind of curious.
Senator Stedman, that's the register that the regulations will be published in, the date the register comes out.
Okay, it will be April.
That's a publication date, but they already have been signed and issued by the Lieutenant Governor.
Okay, kind of a basic question, but when we have disputes or disagreements, I guess, with the industry, and which we have from time to time, and they go through their process, the settlement, as I understand, goes to the CBR fund. Are we expecting, you know, a lot of disagreement with the industry on what they've filed and what our regulations are going to allow, or is everything going to be smooth and we'll have no significant adjustments one way or the other?
Senator Stedman, we actually do not expect to see a dramatic swings in the returns that have been filed to date. Our regulatory process did, because we reached out and did try to align ourselves to a great extent with the existing operating agreements that authorized, you know, was the manner in which they charged one another. There'll be maybe 10% differences in some of that, but because we've been working these regulations in a workshop format for several years, industry is well informed of our interpretations and how we're approaching a lot of the cost elements. So we do not really expect to see many dramatic changes or alterations on audit.
Okay, so we're not expecting then a lot going forward as far as a lot of disagreements and litigation back and forth over several years as we sort this out, is that correct?
That's not the future we see.
We have any other questions for the Deputy Commissioner or the Master of the Audit? Well, thank you for
Master, excuse me.
thank you for coming in today and helping the committee with this issue before us. We have one more presentation. We're going to take a brief at ease while we set that up, and we'll continue on. We're at ease. We're going to come back on the record, and again, you know, we're a little bit flexible in our schedule as the departments are working hard to get their presentations in order. There's other committees within the building working on oil and gas issues, so we're a little discombobulated here. But what we're going to do is take the operating and capital expenditure stuff into the afternoon to give the department a little more time to finish up their presentations, and then this morning, we're going to back up for a minute here on regulations, talk about the topping plant. I think we'll start first trying to, we'll define it for the people at home so it's clear what we're talking about. And then we're going to talk about a upstream capital spending, or basically oil basin spending around the globe. Some information brought forward by the department. We want to talk about that, and then we'll see how much time's left, if we have time for another little topic or not. And then we'll break, or we'll adjourn and come back at 1:30. So, Ms. Davis, if you could help us with the topping plant issue and kind of give us a brief history synopsis, because it was quite the lively topic at the table a couple of years ago.
Thank you, Chairman Stedman. Prior to ACES, you know, the revised tax bill coming forward, the department had received an inquiry from a taxpayer regarding whether or not under PPT the cost of the crude oil topping plant would be deducted. And let me describe what the crude oil topping plant on the Kuparik side is. There are actually two topping plants, crude oil topping plants, and what this means is the North Slope producers need diesel fuel for various of their operations to support their operations. And if they don't have a way to make their own diesel fuel up there, they essentially manufacture it in a plant in Kenai and truck it up. And I think at one time there had been discussion about modifying one of the refinery plants in Fairbanks to do the same, but I think at the time, before that came to fruition, the North Slope producers had essentially early on developed what are called crude oil topping plants. And what this is it's a mini refinery. You take the oil that would otherwise head to the pipeline, and you divert it to a small portion of the oil over to this refinery plant, small refinery plant. And it essentially refines the oil and pulls out the diesel component that makes diesel fuel. And actually, as I recall, early on in the 80s, I think these diesel plants were operating and running. But as air contamination became bigger and bigger issues on the slope, and the EPA started regulating with a finer and finer sieve on what could or could not be emitted on the North Slope, they eventually started outlawing the high sulfur diesel manufacturer up there. So the burning of diesel that had the typical Prudhoe Bay or Kuparik high sulfur content was being outlawed. And so in order for these crude oil topping plants to continue to have a future viability up there, they needed to make a bunch of modifications to them, certainly expensive. And now I'll focus on the Kuparik one because that was the most active diesel plant. In order for them to be able to continue to use that plant, they were going to have to make, and I can't remember the numbers, many orders of millions of dollars of modifications to that plant in order for it to make what's called ultra-low sulfur diesel product. And before they made that investment, they penciled it out and it was not economic. But if they factored in a deduction and the tax ramifications under the PPT law, it would potentially be economic to them. So in other words, as long as the state essentially incurred a chunk of that cost, they were willing and able to move forward. But before they did so, they wanted to verify with the department that we would take the position that the cost of doing that modification to that plant would be deductible. And the department at that time, and this is again before ACES came forward, took the position that that was a downstream cost. And again, what we talk about is terms of point of production. Recall I described that costs upstream of the point of production are deductible, downstream or not, and we didn't see a distinction between whether that oil was going into a pipeline or going into a refinery. It is now a downstream activity, and we would not consider that a deductible expense. So we were at a point of not agreeing. When ACES came before the legislative body, we basically put the issue to the legislature and said, you guys decide. If you want this type of cost to be deductible, then you need to specifically address it. If you do not want it to be deductible, you know, so direct us. And so in the course of the passage of ACES, as Senator Stedman indicates, there was a lot of debate about whether it should or should not be deductible and what the alternatives were if the plants were not modified and what that would involve. And there were issues about moving diesel, buying it from the Alaska market, essentially, and trucking it up to the slope and versus making it on the slope by themselves. Ultimately, the legislature included in the exclusions from lease expenditures costs associated with things like the crude oil topping plant. So what you'll see in our regulations is a reflection of that exclusion. However, we do acknowledge that the cost of acquiring diesel, whether it's through the plant, if they chose to proceed and make those modifications on their own, or whether they're acquiring it from the Kenai. The cost of the diesel itself is a legitimate lease expenditure and may be deductible. And so therefore, in another section, you'll see where it is disallowed, but the on the bottom of page, let's see, where is it? On this copy?
11.
It's on the bottom of page 11, which is the item number 20. We're basically describing a situation where if a person does own a refinery or a crude oil topping plant, we describe the means by which they will calculate what the cost of that product itself is and allow that deduction. And so that's how our regulations have addressed it.
Okay, and just to help me understand the regulations, so they don't get a deduction under the sold expenditure side of it, but what do they get to deduct in the on the cost of the fuel oil? I assume that if they have $500 million or some number on in capital cost to upgrade a particular plant, they're going to pass that through to the fuel product that comes out, and then they can deduct that. Cost through the fuel at the end of the refining process, or how does that?
Senator Stedman, they are allowed to deduct the fair market value of the product that they acquire. Now, obviously, whoever sells them the product is going to be seeking to recover their cost to make the product inherent in the price of it. But it would be a price that's benchmarked in a competitive market. So we as the state accept the fact that the producer would be paying a fair market value to acquire that diesel product. If it comes in less, great, but they can't charge more than the fair market value. We do have certain provisions that deal with how you determine a fair and appropriate charge when a producer owns a facility and then basically makes a product for other producers, and there are charges, and they're on both sides of the equation. We try to make sure and keep those charges fair, and that's somewhat related to your question. But certainly, to the extent a capital charge associated with making the product is inherent in that fair market value price, that would be allowed.
No. Get a little choked up here because Senator Huggins is concerned in his district on his price of diesel fuel at fair market value, and I'm concerned in my district. But when you look at the two, my district's a lot further away from the oil reservoir in Prudhoe Bay than his, yet my diesel fuel price is cheaper. And so I guess it'll be interesting to see how that flows out.
It is.
And with one topping plant, how do you derive the fair market value? Is a comparison by barging the product out of Seattle, or?
Okay, I'll do it. Well, under subsection 20, if you look at what we're saying, if they own the plant, then what we do is we subtract the fair market value of the product from the prevailing value of that oil. So in other words, what we're doing is we recognize that they're making it themselves. So if we ask ourselves, had that barrel of oil gone down taps, what its value would be, and then we subtract the fair market value of what the diesel product is, and we basically derive a value for the oil that would be allowed at that point. And unfortunately, this is one of those, I'd have to literally sit down and map it out, but very smart economists have written this formula for us to make it work.
Okay. Senator Egan.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't understand how you determine the fair market. Can you run through that one more time?
Okay, let me see what we say here. Generally, I mean, there is diesel that is trucked and sold to the slope, and so we would look at any benchmarks that we have for product delivered in the vicinity. And so we do have a fair market value marker in terms of the diesel fuel that is trucked up, and so that would certainly be a key indicator of what a prevailing value. You also have diesel fuel being sold by the crude oil topping plants to other owners and operators on the slope. So we're able to factor in either the delivered price from Kenai plus the sold price coming out of the topping plants to third parties. So we have a pretty good range of price markers to derive a prevailing value on the slope for that product.
So to add on to the chairman's question, so you're not determining any, you know, values from product out of Anacortes or any place like that? I mean, it's all
no.
Alaska.
Yeah, luckily for us, if we have market prices in the location we need, that's what we use. The only time we have to revert to going out and finding a price and backing out transportation costs is if we don't have a competitive market for the product in the place we're trying to benchmark it.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and I think we, any other questions on the topping plant? It's just for those at home, there was a I think there was a termination by one of the companies of some orders of materials that actually sat in Seattle. So it was a pretty big issue here a couple of years ago. But go ahead, Ms. Davis, if you can continue your presentation. I think you have a letter here or a memo from Gaffney Klein you want to talk about?
Yes, I do, Senator Stedman. One of the requests that was made of the department in this presentation, and this will be a piece that perhaps helps set up the afternoon discussion on Alaska's capital expenditure and operating expenditure calculations and experience through our tax returns up to date from, I think, 2006 forward, is an understanding of where Alaska sits globally relative to investments by companies. Because at the beginning of our inquiry, and probably at the end of our inquiry, I believe what I've heard very loud and clear from the legislative body is they want to understand what it is that makes Alaska an attractive place for investment. What is it that the legislative body could do, if anything, to make it as attractive as possible or as attractive as is, you know, reasonable? And so Gaffney Klein had prepared a report for us back in October of 2007 when ACES was first being considered and debated by this body. We asked them to update their data set on expenditures by companies. And what this is a report of is oil company upstream capital spending. And we asked them, obviously from public records that are available, to look at the largest investors in Alaska and ask where else are they investing their dollars? Where else are they spending their money? And how has that changed since our view in 07 to currently? And is that not a reflection of how companies are seeing Alaska, both its fiscal terms and other elements? So with that background, you know, they note that essentially oil companies are for-profit companies, and that there are several factors that affect investment. If your resource potential and other variables are all held the same, obviously government take is the one element that would swing. You're going to find investment going where government take is the lowest, and that's what you would expect. However, things are not all equal or all the same, and prospectivity, in other words, the likelihood of making a discovery and the size of that discovery, also inform the decision as to where you want to invest your dollars. And so probably the best thing to do rather than to ask somebody to tell you what they think is to see where they're actually spending their dollars. You know, the dollars walk the talk, so to speak. So in terms of looking at the pressures and the decision criteria for oil companies, one of the first things that we note in terms of where the large oil companies are spending their money is that almost or more than 70% of the capital spend by these large companies is not in the United States, it's internationally. And whereas we may hear the debate being framed in these halls as being, gee, how does Alaska compare to Texas? How does Alaska compare to Oklahoma? comparisons to the United States is kind of a very small piece of the puzzle. Certainly, it's informative, but what's more informative is how does Alaska compare to the place where 70% of the money is being vested, which is internationally. And there's absolutely no debate, and there'll be some presentations later on to this committee that describe other global regions and looks at Texas. There's no question that the Gulf region of the United States is one of the lowest, if not the lowest, taxing take or government take regimes in the entire world. There's no question of that.
Just for those at home, you may want to add on the Gulf of Mexico why there's such a discrepancy between that and Alaska.
Yes.
And why there's a similarity between Gulf of Mexico and OCS or offshore Alaska.
Right. In the Gulf of Mexico, back in the 80s, a lot of the large company money was leaving. In fact, one of the nicknames of the Gulf of Mexico was called the Gulf of Death for large companies because they had not developed the technology for deep water development. And so the shallow water development around the Gulf was pretty much played out. I mean, they had discovered virtually, you know, most of everything they needed. There were wells punched everywhere. Onshore Texas, which is state land, was also very, very well developed. But the offshore water, particularly the deep water, is outer continental shelf land. It's federal land, similar to Liberty or our outer continental shelf lands. So that's governed by federal royalty rules, governed by the MMS. And historically, the federal government has had a very, very low royalty take. They have had a policy, and perhaps this is as an inducement to national energy security, but they have had a policy of, I won't say giving it away, but certainly relative to other global markets, they have an extremely low take, and it has made it extremely attractive to big oil and going out and developing the deep waters off of the Gulf. And that's not to minimize the high costs that were associated with the deep water developments that they've done and a lot of technology that they've had to develop to access the offshore outer continental shelf oil and gas. But it is currently governed by the federal system for government take down there. And so that's what has made it an attractive location for investment. But with that said, there is, you know, you'd think, wow, if I were big oil, I'd put all my money down there because it's such a low government take. But the problem is that if you're big oil, you have shareholders you're beholden to, and you have an obligation as your reserves are used up to replace your reserves and, in fact, add to your reserves. And frankly, the Gulf of Mexico is not big enough to allow all the big oil companies to replace their reserves simply in that location. It's too small. They have to spread out into the other parts of the world to be able to find resources that add to their portfolios. In addition, that would be a very imprudent action to take if you were a company. I think your shareholders would boot you out pretty quickly after the first hurricane. You can't have all your eggs in one basket and suffer the risk of some catastrophic problem or even a geopolitical one if suddenly a new administration came into place and suddenly decided to ban offshore development from the Gulf. You would be devastated as a company. So you do need to have a diversified portfolio. So for those reasons, outer continental shelf is an important piece of the puzzle, but it's a very small piece of the puzzle. Alaska, as Senator Stedman has indicated, has a substantial resource offshore of Alaska, the outer continental shelf. And pertinent to our discussions yesterday, when we were talking about the production forecast and where are the big prizes, and we talked briefly about heavy oil as being one of the targets because it's in known reservoirs, known resources where there are existing facilities. Another very large target is offshore Alaska. And there have been presentations by Shell, who is one of the dominant players in the outer continental shelf, which would indicate that they see oil resources being able to take our, you know, average daily production back up in the 1 to 1.2, 1.3 billion range for a period of time after the outer continental shelf is opened for oil and gas delivery. And that gets at the line of questioning that Senator Hoffman had yesterday to the TAPS presentation, which is, while outer continental shelf oil would not deliver direct revenues to the state of Alaska in the form of tax and royalty, it would substantially impact the throughput for TAPS. And as we saw in the discussion of tariff, one of the ways you change the tariff charge is by lowering the costs and by increasing the throughput. So certainly increasing the throughput would help us maintain a lower tariff, which then increases our revenues from the other state taxed and royalty-bearing lands. So Gulf of Mexico, analogy to Alaska, they're all very important. So when we come down here to the chart, when we look at the amount of investment that these companies are making internationally versus in the U.S., you'll see that Exxon, BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips are listed. Only ConocoPhillips has a reported Alaska share. The other three companies do a roll-up on their SEC filings and financial filings, so we can't feather out or pull out the Alaska statistics from the overall U.S. statistics. But this is a chart showing where their capital dollars have been spent beginning in 2002 up through 2009, and I believe 2009 are budgetary as opposed to actual. So when we look at this, we see an overall decrease in somewhat in the investment by these companies in U.S. It's increasing, they're increasing their federal spend on average. With that said, there are individual differences among companies. Clearly, each one has their own portfolio and their own need to shift their capital to ensure their health. And looking at that, what we find is Exxon probably has the smallest investment in the U.S. Their largest investment holdings are internationally. BP has the highest percentage spend in the U.S., and that's in part attributable to their large presence in the Gulf of Mexico. And Chevron has substantially decreased their U.S. focus, and they are very focused internationally now.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This is maybe a little off the subject, but I was wondering, as you get toward demarcation point over in the eastern Beaufort Sea, and where does the U.S.-Canadian division come in where all of a sudden we're not dealing, as you go out of continental shelf, are you going straight up the 47th meridian, or what is the?
Senator Olson, I am not that well steeped. Perhaps DNR and their cartographers would be a better answer. I know that there are international treaties that are very specific about how you take the country boundary and extend it out, and it usually is dependent upon the projections from the landmass and how that line just happens to run. It isn't always vertical along a longitude line. Oftentimes it's affected by the topography and the jutting out of the shoreline as to how they, it usually is my recollection of the last treaty I read on this.
How about submarine geology?
Well, it's literally you look at the shoreline and you take the projections, and wherever that projection is, you essentially bisect the outermost projection between the land masses and draw the line up the center.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So the conclusion of the Gaffney-Klein report to us was that informing how we approach an analysis of ACEs, you know, the Alaska's production tax, and what can or cannot be done to improve Alaska as an investment location, they advised us of two things. One, that we do need to take into account the fact that the money is really, the lion's share of the money is targeted toward internationally. So Alaska needs to position itself vis-a-vis the international options as opposed to whether money is or is not going into Texas. And two, when they looked at the international, and I skipped over it up here because I didn't, that's going to be really the subject of a later presentation where we get into the details of these international jurisdictions. But by and large, Alaska is not the most expensive government take in international comparisons. In fact, we're probably middle-ranked, middle of the board. But with respect to that, when we look at where the international monies are being invested in the last couple years, they are actually going into jurisdictions with very high government takes. And so what that tells us is that these companies are investing, their decision to invest is not being driven by the government take analysis, but it's being driven by other factors, which would include whether or not there are prizes, potential prizes there that would add large stakes to their reserve portfolios. It may be certainly other factors that are driving it. And we just need to be thoughtful in how we approach what we do to ensure that we're doing our best to attract investment.
So we're going to have more detail coming.
Absolutely.
And I think we've got some historic presentations in the last few years. And those of you that happen not to have them in your office or need a copy, we can get them online, or I have copies of them. Certainly, there's a lot of, under PPT and under ACES, there was a lot of review, so we could, and we'll also have our consultant coming in Monday. Mm-hmm. And this will probably be one of the subjects he talks about a little bit. And we'll see what his opinion is when he gets here. Any questions? I think that wraps up the morning session.
Yes, sir.
We're going to go ahead and adjourn the meeting. We'll reconvene at promptly 1:30. We'll go into operating and capital costs, so things will start getting interesting as we put this puzzle together. Meeting adjourned.